Welcome to this issue's episode of the Beaver Breakdown, the official companion podcast to the Beaver newspaper.
Hosted by your Beaver Sound editors, Dylan Lowe
and Lily Whittle. This podcast releases in conjunction with the Beaver newspaper, so you can listen along as you read.
From Part B to opinion, news to sport, anybody that's written for the Beaver, this podcast gives them the opportunity to talk to us a little bit more about what inspired their piece and for us to bring up any questions we feel the piece evokes. In this episode, I talked to Anya and Nina from News about their piece covering the UCU strikes.
And I talked to Rob from Sports about his analysis of the ongoing Qatar World Cup. Hey Rob, welcome to episode 4 of the Beaver Breakdown. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview. So before we begin the interview proper, could you introduce yourself to the audience and give a summary of the article you wrote today?
Hi Dylan. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Rob. I'm a second year IR and history student, and I wrote a World Cup article recently, just previewing the tournament, some exciting narratives to look out for, some players, teams, just generally an article for people to read and get excited about the World Cup.
So from your article, you seem to favour either Messi's Argentina or Neymar's Brazil to win the World Cup. Am I right to say this? If I'm wrong, who do you think is going to take it home?
That was sort of the main talking point going into the tournament, wasn't it? Whether Brazil finally have a complete team. And I mean, I sort of describe it in my article, but they have a terrifying front line. It's absolutely stacked with like stars of world football. They seem to have finally got a complete team around Neymar. Argentina, similarly, the managers found a balance around Messi. And yes, they lost the first game to Saudi Arabia, didn't they? But they've bounced back, they're through to the knockouts. And with Messi, I don't see why they can't keep going. And in terms of other favorites, I mean, I feel like England still have a gear in them. You would hope so, wouldn't you? I mean, they definitely have one of the best teams in the tournament. France as well. France could definitely go far. When you have a player like Mbappe who can just dominate games. We talked about this before we started recording, didn't we? That he could just, you know, you have a game where it's a 0-0, you don't see anything happening, and then he just turns it on, grabs the game by the scruff of the neck, and just dominates. It's incredible.
How about underdogs? So every World Cup, we seem to have underdog storylines. So Ghana in 2010, Costa Rica in 2014. And obviously, there have been some underperformers who have been performing really well this World Cup. So who do you think that will be this tournament?
Yeah, so we're recording this on Friday. And I mean, after last night's game, it's hard not to mention Japan, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, so Japan, surprisingly, in a group with Spain and Germany, they beat both of them, lose to Costa Rica, and they're through as top of the group. Honestly, they're a very exciting side to watch. I mean, last World Cup as well, they almost beat Belgium. But yeah, I'd say Japan is probably the standout. I think the US can surprise quite a few teams as well, though. They're up against the Netherlands in the knockouts, and they have a young, hungry team. So I think they're one to look out for as well.
Let's talk a bit more about individual awards. So who do you think is going to be the top scorer of the competition, for example?
Well, these are harder to predict, aren't they, the individual stuff. But Mbappe, we have to mention him, don't we? He's on 3 goals, I think, at the moment. And just every game he plays, it's like he goes up another gear. You think he's done. You think he can't do more. And he dominates games, even against the biggest opposition. I mean, Mbappe, Messi, I think you have to mention him. Ronaldo had that goal taken off him. It was given to Bruno Fernandes in the Uruguay game. But yeah, I'd say Messi, Mbappe, and maybe a rogue shout. I don't know how rogue it is, but Richarlison of Brazil.
Yeah, that crazy goal. It was really, really impressive.
I think it was Switzerland, wasn't it? The scissor kick. But Richarlison, definitely, yeah. I mean, anyone who plays up top for Brazil, they're just full of goals, full of talent, full of goals. So I'd say those three, Mbappe, Richarlison, Messi.
Do you think those players are also in contention for player of the tournament, or do you think it's going to be someone else, maybe a midfielder like Pedri?
Pedri's definitely a good shout. I like the look of Pedri with Gavi in the Spain midfield. They're so technical. It's like, you know, Spain, every few years, they just spawn in these young, talented midfielders from nowhere, you know? You had Xavi Iniesta back in the day, and now you have Pedri, Gavi. I don't know. I feel like with football being so biased towards forward and attacking players, and the stats and the goals and the assists, I can't see it not going to Mbappe. I mean, last tournament, I think it was Mbappe who won the Golden Ball, and then Kane won the Golden Boot. I guess it depends which side goes far, isn't it? And then Neymar as well. We haven't talked about him yet, but as soon as he's back from injury, He'll definitely give Brazil another gear, another level to go to. So if he can turn it on in the knockouts, yeah, I don't see why not.
How about young players? Every tournament, we always have a breakout star, you know. I mean, they don't necessarily have to be young, but who do you think is going to be the breakout star from this World Cup?
I've tried to watch as many games as possible, obviously. Not great with the essay deadlines, but yeah, I'd say I like the look of Cody Gakpo. Not many will have heard of him before the tournament. Dutch striker, plays for PSV in the Dutch league. Something crazy, I looked up the stats. So far this season, he's had 33 goals and assists in 29 games. It is the Dutch league, bear in mind, but he's just amazing. He's young, he's quick, he's strong. The only issue there is the Dutch side are a bit overly reliant on him, I'd say. So I don't know how far they could go, but him on his own, I think he's 22 years old. He looks incredible. I would have said Jamal Musiala as well of Germany, but obviously they've been knocked out last night, haven't they? As you know better than me. Yeah, I like the look of Cody Gakpo, yeah.
Obviously we're recording this on Friday, so not all the round of 16 matches are solidified yet. But of the matches right now, which do you think is the one to watch? The must-catch one that will be the most interesting?
Wow, okay. So the games we know for now are, I think, Netherlands-USA would definitely be one to look out for. I could see the US snatching a result there. I don't know. The Netherlands aren't as convincing. Obviously, they seem to cruise through the group. Ecuador, Senegal, Qatar. But I can definitely see the US challenging them. The US looked amazing against England, and I thought fully deserved that draw. Again, people might have their own opinion, but I was surprised, pleasantly surprised. Thought they played well. Of the other games, Australia-Argentina could be an interesting one, because Australia, no one ever really talks about them, and it's not a bad thing. It's just they don't really have any, you know, big players people talk about. Most of their players play in the Australian League, but they've somehow finished level on points in the group with France, and they're just quietly going about their business. And if Messi's Argentina can't turn it on like they failed against Saudi Arabia, I think that game could get scrappy. I could see Australia snatching a goal. Otherwise, England-Senegal, definitely. I mean, Senegal, obviously, without Sadio Mane, that will definitely hurt them. But still, lots of attacking, talented players. Ismail Assar, I like the look of him. He's amazing. England should cruise through that game, but Senegal will definitely give them a tough fight, I think.
For our final question, so obviously, you know, I am or was a Germany fan, and yeah. I'm looking for a new team to support now that Germany have been knocked out. So who are you supporting for this World Cup, like, personally?
Myself, personally, I mean, as a football fan, Argentina, I'd say. It would just be amazing. Messi's last World Cup, Ronaldo's as well, let's not forget that. It would just be amazing to see Messi lift it, wouldn't it? Like, if in a couple of weeks' time, he lifts the trophy in wherever the final is being played, it'd be an amazing story. But to anyone listening who doesn't have a team, maybe, you're just sort of looking for a team to get behind, see how far they can go. It's an interesting storyline. I'd say Japan. I mean, they're really the feel-good story. Maybe not for you as a Germany fan. But yeah, it's just such great technical players. And I find it incredible. Like, they can win games. They can grind out results without having the ball. Last night's win against Spain, we talked about this briefly before, something incredible, like 17% possession against Spain, and they still win, and you can't say they didn't deserve it. They made great chances, they won. They're up against Croatia next, which would really suit them, because Japan looked great against teams that dominate the ball. Again, Germany, they beat in their first game. I don't see why they can't reach the quarterfinals. They're definitely one to look out for, and if you're looking for a team to support, why not go for Japan? I'd recommend it.
Thank you so much for your recommendations, and thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thanks so much for having me, Dylan. Cheers.
So hello guys, and welcome to the fourth episode of the Beaver Breakdown. Thank you so much for giving me your time to interview you. If you just start off by introducing yourselves to everybody listening.
Okay, hi, I'm Nina Lepilahti. I'm a first year postgraduate. I'm doing political theory at the LSE, and I am a reporter for the Beaver.
Hi, I'm Anya. I'm first year undergrad doing politics and international relations, and I'm also a reporter for the news section of the Beaver.
So we're going to be talking about your news piece today that covers the UCU strikes that were going on this week. So in kind of a short summary, could you please just talk about the issues that the strikes were raising?
Yep, so there were kind of four main issues that were being raised within LSE and also nationally by the UCU. And this were issues that were focusing on the pay cuts, the casualisation of labour, an increase in workloads and a lack of equality within the sector. So to kind of give some background on that, the UCU have released some statistics and they said, for example, student numbers have increased while permanent staff have decreased. For example, from 2014 to 2020, the ratio of from staff to student has gone from 1 to 11 to 1 to 16. So as you can see, this is quite an increase in workload and pay has been cut during that time as well.
Yeah, I think that that's a pretty good summary by Anya of the four fights that were being raised by the strikers. What I realized is that especially these issues pertaining to pay and pension were raised quite a lot by them, especially in light of the current cost of living crisis. And then something that was like a very powerful statement, which was by one of the professors I interviewed, Dr. Nina Vindem Rasmussen. She said that all of these issues kind of come together and make academia not feel sustainable in the long run, despite many of the staff members at LSE really loving academia.
So you were live reporting on the picket line. What was it like? Was there a real sense of like, camaraderie? Was it quite busy? Like, what was the atmosphere like?
So I definitely think that there was a very strong sense of community and of solidarity. A lot of the people that I interviewed at the picket lines were kind of in more privileged positions compared to some of their colleagues. So there were some professors who were, for example, part of permanent staff or had kind of like climbed quite high up the job ladder at LSE. And they also said that even though some of these issues definitely were their issues as well, especially the pension issue, they were saying that they are striking mainly because of their colleagues and because they recognize that not everyone is in such a privileged position as they are. So that's something that I thought showed a lot of, solidarity and community at the picket lines.
Yeah, just on what Nina was saying about that, there was definitely a sense of like camaraderie from different levels in the hierarchy. So for example, I was speaking to Dr. Banerjee. She's like a professor in media and culture change, and she's worked at the LSE for about 13 years now. And throughout her academic profession, she's been in kind of the lower sort of chains in the hierarchy. So she's experienced what her colleagues are like going through now. And I think that's kind of like added to this sense of collaboration because they can really empathize and see what's going on is an issue that can only be changed by everyone supporting each other rather than just the people that are being worstly affected.
So obviously as student journalists at the Beaver, it's really important to report on issues happening on LSE campus. But I think the kind of important thing to bring up here is that these strikes aren't just about LSE and they're not just happening on LSE campus. So could you just explain for the listeners a little bit more about what has been going on across the whole country with strike action and how the UCU is sort of mobilising across the country?
Yeah, so the UCU are kind of protesting on the four main issues, and one of the main things driving this is that there's been a pay cut of around like 25% since 2009, and obviously with inflation, employers have only been offered around a 3% increase in pay, which is actually like a cut relative to inflation. And they're demanding five main things, some of which are a fair pay deal and a more equality on pay gaps and a restoration of the USS pension benefits. And as Nina was saying, this is one of the main issues with professors saying that their pensions have in effect been robbed from them. I think the USS thought that there'd be some sort of shortfall in the pension pot, so they massively cut pensions, but that was actually based on miscalculation. So there's been around like a $5 billion surplus or profit from the USS during this time, which obviously within the cost of living crisis and other things happening across the country is a really bad thing to be having on news headlines.
Yeah, exactly. So there are these issues that are brought by the UCU that are kind of like nationwide issues. But a point that a lot of the picketers raised, in my opinion, was that there is not really any reason that even though these issues exist at the LSE in the same way, there is not really any reason that like such an elite and profitable institution like the LSE should kind of let the profits accrue at the top and treat staff as largely disposable. So they were kind of raising that the LSE, if anyone, really does not have any excuse.
Just kind of adding on that, something that I was talking to people about that I was interviewing on the picket line, they were saying that these sorts of things aren't really hidden from public, from the public as well. For example, like if you look at the disproportionate wage of Manoush compared to like other people who have more kind of like student to student time, it just shows that like this obviously isn't an institution that should be having to make pay cuts.
So now you've kind of both been on the picket line and you've spoken to striking teachers. Do you feel there is a sense of hope for the future and that we can see a change happening in the future?
I think there's definitely this kind of desperation for hope. Some people I spoke to said that they don't know whether or not there kind of needs to be a further like crash and people to reach breaking point for change to actually happen, which obviously is not the ideal situation. But I think there's definitely this sense of power amongst the unity of staff and students. And on the picket line, we've seen both students collaborating with the staff, and that's obviously a really positive thing. And Dr. Banerjee again told me about how around 8 years ago, the union actually lobbied against a pay dip in wages, which was largely successful. And more recently, the cut wages that they've had happened to them because of their strikes. They've managed to negotiate LSE to put these in like a student hardship fund. So they definitely have some sort of lobbying power and have been able to enact like positive change. So I think they hope to do more of this with like more student staff support and collaboration.
Yeah, I agree that there is definitely hope. I would say that among the picketeers, the answer to this was kind of yes and no, so that there's definitely hope that the LSE listens and that, as Anya said, there have been kind of like, there have been instances before where the staff has managed to lobby for change successfully. And especially now, since obviously through striking, they're showing how indispensable they are. They will be probably able to, or hopefully able to, change a lot of things. But then at the same time, some of the changes do need to come from a more government level. And among the picketers, there was not much hope that the current government really cares about kind of workers' rights. We've been seeing a lot of strikes across the country in a lot of different sectors. But yeah, then again, there are definitely issues such as the N2 casualization and kind of reallocation of money that can come directly from LSE management, which hopefully the staff can, where the staff can be a force for the better.
To finish on the note of what we can do moving forward, so what can our listeners, so what can students do to support striking workers and to support the UCU's four fights, especially now that the kind of the picket line is gone?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing that people on the picket line, the professors and members of staff, were saying to us was just to make a fuss in any way, shape or form. So talk to your friends about it. Email and social media are both obviously massive powers, powerful movers of change. So you could either email part of the leadership team or email Manoush and complain about a loss of learning. Something that people have done in the past is tried to claim back fees for disruption to learning, which they thought was quite a powerful thing to do from our behalf. Using hashtags and things like that on social media, such as UCU Rising, has been also recommended to us. And also kind of like tell members of staff that, you know, have been striking that you support them.
Yeah, that's something I heard a lot as well, about just telling your teachers that you support them, and kind of like raising awareness with your co-students. And then a big one as well was emailing management. And one of the professors also mentioned that Minu Shafiq in her book says that she recognizes the kind of importance of these labor unions. So kind of calling upon her to practice what she preaches also inside her own home is definitely a very important thing to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Beaver Breakdown.
If you ever write a piece for The Beaver, do get in touch with us. We'd love to interview you.
See you next time.
Bye.